The following message is from New Life Gillette series, Love Math. This week, Pastor Mike presents part three of this series.
Good morning. Half asleep or frozen. Good morning. I am excited for you guys to be here today. We are in week three of a series we are calling Love Math. I am Mike. I'm one of the pastors here at New Life. Let me say welcome to those of you who are watching online and to the guys over at the prison and to those of you who are here in the room. It is Valentine's week. You're welcome, guys, for the reminder. Is it Wednesday? Is that right? Thursday. Well, I was going to miss that one. Okay, Thursday. Don't forget to buy the jewelry in the lobby for your significant other or for your mama or for your daughter. But because this is kind of Valentine's week, we are going to talk about
marriage. Marriage is what brings us together today.
Yeah, and it may sound strange for a church to talk about marriage. You'd spend an entire service talking about marriage, but it's really not that strange. I think Valentine's Day may be one of the most spiritual of all the holidays, because Valentine's Day is all about
and love, true love.
That's one of the greatest scenes of any movie ever. I love that movie. It's a week all about love. So we're going to talk about love here today. Growing up in the church, I learned a progression, steps that Christians take, at least Christians in the type of Christian I grew up in, steps that Christians take in romantic relationships. And this isn't something that's explicitly written in the Bible, like you have to do things in this order, but some wise Christians over the centuries have determined that as we study scripture and we understand kind of how it describes what a romantic relationship should look like, we can put things in this order and kind of line up with the heart of scripture, the principles that scripture lays out. So we're going to go through that progression together today. And your progression may be slightly different based on how you grew up, and you may have different opinions about how it should be, but this is kind of a general idea. So step number one is we all start here. We are all single in the beginning. We talked about this last week. That says single. I just can't see it. We talked about this last week, and we talked about how there's different kinds of singleness. There are people who are single and satisfied, and there are people that are single and searching. Good job. You paid attention. Single and satisfied, or single and searching. People that are satisfied are people that are single by calling. They're single because in their singleness, they can accomplish something they couldn't if they were in a relationship. Then those people who are single and searching, in other words, they don't want to stay in their singleness. That's just kind of their current situation. They move on to step number two. And step number two is dating. Single, and then we become dating. And dating in the church has kind of gotten a bad name over my lifetime. Dating was just kind of something you did when I was really young, and then some books came out and some people started talking about how dating is bad. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think you can do dating badly. I think if you don't do dating correctly, it is bad. But I think that dating is actually a very helpful process in determining what it is we should be looking for in our future spouse. If our goal in romantic relationships is to find a spouse, to find somebody that we're going to spend the rest of our lives with, then we need a dating process, an interview process, to be able to say, you know what? I don't think my spouse should have this characteristic because the person I'm dating really does. Or I'm looking for somebody who does this because the person I'm dating does not. We're looking for somebody who will make us a better person and who's not going to drive us crazy in this dating process. And I believe that the reason why I was able to find somebody who fits so well with me and my wife is because I dated a lot of people who were nothing like my wife. And I decided, this isn't what I want to end up with. I hope none of the girls I dated, you're all great, but I love my wife. If they're watching on. But eventually, I found out what I was looking for in a wife, and I found Darcy. And she worked with that. And so, and she was what I was looking for. And so when that happened, I experienced something that I hadn't experienced before called love when I found Darcy. And love, the type of love I'm talking about, does not happen overnight. It doesn't come easily. Love at first sight, when you're talking about the kind of love I'm talking about, is impossible. Love is developed. Love is produced. And so in love, to be honest, our culture uses the word love to mean a wide variety of different things. Love is not any one single thing. You can love a piece of bread and love your wife. It's a confusing word because it's just too broad. The type of love we're talking about today is not something that you can do with a piece of love or a piece of bread. Sorry. The type of love I'm talking about today is something that arises when something changes inside of you. And I remember the moment it happened for me. I remember when I experienced love, this kind of love, for the first time. We were sitting in the parking lot of a Steak and Shake. Anybody ever heard of Steak and Shake? We don't have them around here. Yeah, okay. We were sitting in the parking lot of a Steak and Shake, and I realized something about the way I was feeling about Darcy. I realized that I cared more about her happiness in that moment than about my own. I wanted to give her something that I wanted for myself. And so my desire to love her, my feelings of love, changed from what can I get out of this, but I love you so much, I care so much about you that I want to give you something that I want. And it didn't, that I wasn't perfect in love. It wasn't like the pinnacle of love in that moment. I just got a taste of it. And I realized we're ready for something more. This is important. This is different than what I've experienced in the past. And so we moved on to the next step. We knew it was time for engagement. Someday I want to tell you this story, but I don't have time today. But we got engaged. And this is kind of something that Christians developed. Not Christians. It happened for a long time in our history. But this is something that we kind of use as a statement to the world, something has changed. We have new intentions. We're drawing a line now. We have intentions to do more than just date. This is a statement that you make to the rest of the world. And when this happens, you start to make more concrete plans. See, back in the dating and when you're recognizing the love thing, everything's still about feelings. And most of it is about emotions. But engagement is when things start to become more concrete. This is when we start to combine finances. This is when we start to talk about where are we going to live and who's going to do what jobs and how many kids do you want to have. And we start to make plans. And it becomes more concrete. And if that happens well, if the love thing happens, we've checked that off the box. If we did the planning and it didn't drive us crazy and drive us away from each other and we realized we're actually kind of compatible in this area too, then the next step is obvious. Then comes marriage and then later a baby in a baby carriage. If all the planning goes well, if the love thing kind of happens, then we move into this marriage, and marriage is healthy because we've kind of done things in the right order. And we're going to spend some time on this idea of marriage today, because marriages that have kind of done things in the right order and continue in the right way, continue this sacrificial love idea, eventually get to the place where their marriages, their relationships are defined by sacrifice. Their marriages become sacrificial. I'm not in this marriage for what I can get out of it. The excitement of the early on stuff and what I was hoping to get out of this marriage, and I was lonely and now I'm not lonely anymore. All of that emotion and excitement has started to wear off, but you've realized that I'm not in this marriage for what I can get out of it. I'm in this marriage for what I can give away. And this type of loving relationship grows and grows and grows until it gets to the point where it is defined by sacrifice. It becomes sacrificial. This is why we say all the time that good relationships start selfish. This is the process where we're trying to figure out what we want in a spouse, what we want to get out of a relationship, who can make us a better person. And so that's the selfish part, and it's kind of necessary in the beginning. But eventually they become sacrificial, to where I'm not in this for what I can get out of it. I'm in this for what I can give to it, because I care so much about you that I want to give you something that I actually want. And this is where we're going to spend some time today, because you don't really know how much you love somebody until you have sacrificed for that person. You know this is true when you've gotten into a marriage and you realize something. And when you first got married, it was really cute, that thing that they did, that little quirk that they have. But after about the 10th year of that quirk, it's starting to not be quite so cute. You can relate. But we remind ourselves time and time again, I can put up with your quirk because I'm not in this for what I can get out of it. I'm in this for what I can give to it. Because we really don't know if we love somebody until we've gone through the dirty times together. Until we've gone through the bad times together. I remember the first time I got like really sick after Darcy and I were married, and I was laying in bed in my underwear, and just trying to paint a full picture here for you. You're welcome. And I don't know why. I was laying in bed, and the urge hit me. I realized I'm about to puke. I am sick. I'm about to throw up. So I jump out of bed, run down the hallway, get to the bathroom. I see the toilet. It's in my vision. I'm about to make it, but the vomit's not waiting. And it flies out of my mouth all over her brand new curtains on the wall. Yes, the O is right. But my incredible wife, I knew my wife loved me, but because I was so sick, I could barely stand, she cleaned up all my puke. She washed the curtains. Now, forever, those curtains, one of them has always been shorter than the other one now. Because somehow in the wash, one of them shrank more than the other. So we now have an eternal reminder of my wife's love for me in these curtains. Because you really don't know how much you love somebody until you've done something that you don't want to do for them. Until she ate the last fry off of your plate. Until you've had to put up with him for the 10th time, not able to see the milk that's right in front of him in the refrigerator. Can't find the milk. It's right there! Time and time again, we have to put up with things, and it's when we are able to put up with things without getting angry, because we recognize we're not in the relationship for what we can get out of it, that we start to become sacrificial in our love for each other. This is why when I hear teenagers talk about love, and teenagers specifically, Generation Z, they have an entirely different definition of the word love than most older people when they think about the word love. The word love implies much more about sex than about anything else. And so when you think about, when I hear teenagers talking about how they love each other, I just think, you are not in love, you are in heat. This is purely emotional. This is purely desire. This has nothing to do with what I think about when I think about love, right? And that's okay. I don't think there's anything specifically spiritual about the letters in a word. I mean, words change meaning over time. You try to read some of the words in the King James Version, you're like, I don't know what this means, because the words over time change meanings. And that's okay. That's why we have to remind ourselves what a word means right now to the people I'm talking about. So today, to clarify, the type of love that I am talking about is this type of love. The type of love we read about in Ephesians chapter 5. This is probably the most famous of the marriage passages. And if you haven't read it recently, I would say go back, please, and read Ephesians chapter 5. But this verse says this: husbands, love your wives. How? Just as Christ loved the church. How did Christ love the church? Christ died for the church. So how are husbands to love their wives? Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. This is love. Sacrifice, not what can I get out of it, not I'm attracted to you, not any of this. Love is sacrifice. True love is sacrificial, just as Jesus gave himself up for the church. And that is how the next step comes into play. That sacrificial love is how we change from what can I get out of this to eventual discipleship. discipleship. Discipling is the process of two people living life alongside each other in such a way that we learn from each other, we grow together, not just we grow like closer together, but also we grow up together, we mature together, and as we grow closer to Christ, we grow closer to each other. We grow together. That's discipleship. And discipleship requires this process of sacrificial love. So we're taught, in order to accomplish this discipleship thing, to submit to each other. And this doesn't mean that we have to wait until we get through all of these steps to start discipleship. This doesn't mean that you have to be perfect and you have to have been elevated to a certain level in order to do discipleship correctly. In fact, I think everybody at every journey can be a disciple. But there is a point at which, when we have discovered what it looks like to love sacrificially, that we can be most effective at discipleship. So what does discipleship look like in our marriage relationships? Discipleship looks like mutual submission. So we continue reading. Now as the church submits to Christ, that's kind of a given, the church submits to Christ, we not a location is the church, we are not in the church, we are the church. The church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything, to which every lady in the room gets a little bit nervous and you start to feel your ear right up here turn red. What's he about to say about wives submitting to husbands? This is one of those touchy passages because a lot of people like to just take this one and stop, especially men. Can we just end the conversation now and move on? No, we can't, because there's a verse right after this that has quite a challenge for men. That says this, we just read it. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up. Men, are we ready to die for our wives? Yeah. If we're expecting our wives to submit to us, what then does this passage require of us? That we submit back, so much to the point that we're ready to submit our entire lives. And this equation looks like this. You have a wife saying, I'm less than, I'm submitting. And you have a husband saying, I'm less than, I'm submitting. And what does that lead to? Multiplication. This is why we considered calling this series Bad Math for Good Relationships. Because the math doesn't work, but it's true. That's because this equation is trying to describe in physical terms something that is not physical. This equation is explaining in physical terms something that is spiritual. Mathematically, it doesn't work, but it's true. Because sacrificial love, persons that find themselves in a submitting, mutual submission relationship, have a desire to multiply that love. And not, I'm not just talking about multiplying as far as the offspring stuff goes. And I'm not talking about multiply in terms of having babies, although that's a big part of it. We'll get to that in just a minute. But love multiplies because it's contagious. When people experience true sacrificial love, this is rare to them. This is something that they don't see in the world. When they see love portrayed on movies and when they see love portrayed in the relationships of the broken marriages around them, they just don't see this kind of love that often. So when people come in contact with sacrificial love, it's contagious and it multiplies. It grows and it expands. Because sacrificial love requires mutual submission. Sacrificial love requires mutual submission. This is the discipleship process we're talking about. And this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it was created to be. In fact, you look back at the very beginning of time, at the way things were in the garden. At the beginning, we see that this is the way it was supposed to be. Man and woman, we're governing together. We're overseeing creation together. We're ruling over creation together as one. Two people as one, ruling together. And then sin entered the equation and screwed it all up. Sin is what screwed that up. Because this is what, look at the very beginning. Genesis 3:6 says, so Eve took the sin. This is the description of the first sin. So Eve took some of the fruit and ate it. Then she gave, this is kind of showing us, and you look at the first few passages or verses in Genesis, and you kind of see that the two becoming one union, this beautiful harmony of two people giving themselves to each other, being with each other, being completely transparent with each other and naked. Then she gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it too. And in this picture, up to this point, everything is as it was created to be. And when they committed this first sin, there were consequences. And the first place that you see consequences arise are in relationships. So when we continue reading on in Genesis chapter 3, verse 7 shows us what those consequences were. The first consequence was shame. And suddenly they recognized their nakedness. And they were naked before and they didn't recognize it because this is not just because they didn't have clothes. This is meant to show us this kind of transparent, we live together, two people becoming one, this transparency with God and with each other. This is the reason they were naked. And now all of a sudden they feel shameful because their transparency is revealing a problem that has arisen because of sin. The second consequence is hiding, so they hid. Before they were completely transparent and living life hand to hand with God, they were living with God in the garden, and then because they felt shame, they decided to hide from God. We can relate to this, not just in our relationship with God, but in our relationships with our spouses. When we do something we know we shouldn't, we want to hide things. Our relationships were never created to have any kind of hiding. Our relationships, if they are the way they were created to be, should be marked by complete transparency. There's nothing to hide. The second consequence is fear. I was afraid because I was naked. Fear is a consequence of sin. It's the reason why all throughout Scripture, the angels and God and Jesus are always saying, do not fear. When you're with God, when you're completely transparent in this beautiful relationship with God, there's no reason to be fear, to be fearful. When that relationship is broken, then we fear. Then we have fear in our lives. The next consequence is blame. The woman made me do it. The snake made me do it. Not to take responsibility for our own actions. And now as a result of sin, pain has entered the world. And that once beautiful, harmonious relationship between Adam and Eve and God is broken. But there are even more consequences. Next consequence was struggle. You will struggle to scratch a living. Did you know we were not meant to have to work so hard to survive? Did you know you were not meant to have to worry about where you were going to get enough money to eat? When Adam and Eve, when they were first created, the food, the nature, and the animals, and Adam and Eve just kind of all worked together in harmony. That breaking, the reason why we have to toil so hard is a result of sin. And pain entered the world. In pain, Eve will give birth. To which every mom in the room says, yep. That's a consequence of sin. Next one is inequality. This is where we're going to land on this one today. You will desire to control your husband. That desire is sin. That desire is a result of the fall. You will desire to control your husband. What else is a result of sin? But he will rule over you. That's not the way it was created to be, but this is the result of sin. They were created to live in mutual submission, for two people to be one, for them to rule over nature together. They're different from nature. They are ruling over nature, but because of sin, because of pride, the original sin, this happened. The equation changed. And one person was saying, I'm greater and I'm ruling, I'm the ruler, I'm the leader. And one person saying, no, I'm greater, I'm ruling, I'm the leader. As a result of sin. And that doesn't multiply well. That leads to division. So now divorce enters the equation when it wasn't even a consideration before. Now separation and gossip and anger enter the equation as a result of sin. The fact that men are naturally physically stronger than women will cause them to want to wield that power over women because of sin. So what is the solution? Because selfishness or pride is the original sin that caused us to want to lord over each other, to rule over each other. So we have to swing the pendulum in the opposite direction and look for a solution to that sin. If we are naturally tempted to rule over each other, we should do the opposite of that thing. And the opposite of that thing is to submit. The solution is sacrificial love. And this submission thing doesn't just happen in marriage. This happens in all of our relationships. So we expand the conversation now to apply it to the church, to apply it to parents and children, to apply it to friendships. How do we mutually submit and love sacrificially the way Jesus loved in the garden, the way God loved in the garden? And amazingly, God reveals to us that it was not just us being told to submit to him, but he also submitted to us. Galatians, continuing, go back to that passage in Galatians 5. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ, how did Christ love the church? Gave himself up for her. We are called to submit to one another, and in doing so, we produce discipleship. This is what discipleship is. This is the mutual submission thing that happens as we grow together, as we submit to each other, we grow closer to God. That's why Jesus called his followers disciples. And this leads us to the next natural step in the progression in marriages, children. When Darcy and I dealt with infertility for 8 years, it always confused me why it was so painful. Why was it so painful for each miscarriage and every negative pregnancy test? Why did that make me emotional? Because I hadn't lost anything. I never had it in the first place. It's because God put something inside of us that makes love want to multiply. Because when we experience love, we cannot wait to give that love to somebody else. Not to fulfill our own desires, not to fulfill our own needs, but to give that love that we've experienced and that overflows, and we cannot wait to give it away. And in marriage relationships, this is the most natural progression, that when we develop this love in a relationship, we cannot wait to hand it off. And the most natural thing in the world is to give it to our children, because love gives birth to love. When we experience love, naturally, most people want to pass that love off to others. We want to procreate that love into more and more lives. But I've met people, especially through counseling, who have gotten this out of order. And this progression is important, because when you get things out of order, when you try to put the physical stuff too early in the conversation, when you start to get married before you're ready to get married, when you start to have children before you're ready to get or have children, it just kind of makes things harder, makes things more difficult, because you'll see girls who get pregnant because they're lonely and they want to bring somebody into the world that they can have with them to alleviate their loneliness, which means they're bringing somebody in the world to fulfill their own desires rather than to hand off love. That's unhealthy. That's not the way to start a relationship. And then you have women who are feeling like a relationship is breaking apart and he's going to leave unless I do something, so she gets pregnant to kind of nail him down. And then the children are not just something that I can created so that I can get something out of it, but so that I can use the children. Then children become a job. We have to stay together because now we got kids. Because God gave us the ability to make children so that we could hand off the love that he handed off to us. God created us in order to help hand off love to more people, to spread this love. And children are a way to make that happen. And let me just say this to those of you who are in this room who may have gotten things out of order in your past. Maybe you got married when you shouldn't have. You made some decisions in some romantic relationships you shouldn't have. You gave your body away before you should have. You took advantage of somebody you shouldn't have. If you are in that place, please don't allow any of this to make you feel condemned. You are not damned because you got things out of order in the romantic relationship area. Because we don't just believe that God forgives, we believe God heals. God mends broken relationships just like he mends broken bodies. God can allow two people who have been split apart to come back together. I talked to somebody after first service who that happened to just recently. God heals relationships. And so my prayer for you, if you've experienced brokenness in a relationship for one reason or another, my prayer for you is that God will heal your relationships and that you will go out of your way to sacrifice so that that can happen. Because Jesus taught us how. How much did you love Jesus before you became a Christian? You didn't. You got into your relationship with Jesus to get something out of it. You got into your relationship with Jesus because you didn't want to go to hell, or because you were experiencing emotional pain and you thought it would help, or because you felt hopeless and you wanted hope, or you felt there was no peace and you wanted peace, or whatever it was that drew you to God, or a girlfriend that happened to be going to church. And you went into it for selfish reasons, but eventually over time, those of us who have been maturing down this spiritual walk for a while start to, now I'm no longer in this for what I can get out of it, I'm in this for what I can give to it. So I'm willing to take a pastor's salary. So I'm willing to go to Haiti. So I'm willing to write a check that I don't want to write. So I'm willing to serve when I don't feel like it. I'm willing to do things that I don't want to do because I'm in this relationship with God thing, not for what I can get out of it, but because of what I can give to it. That's the maturing process. To which Jesus revolutionized what it looks like to be a leader. When Jesus came to this earth and he started serving his disciples, everybody's like, what are you doing? I want to read a story for you out of my son's Bible, if I can. We read this Bible every night before he goes to bed. And if you have not got a Bible for your grandkids or for your kids, I highly recommend this one. I don't get any money for recommending it, but it's really good because it shows how the whole Bible points forward to Jesus. And This story I'm about to read is the story of when Jesus is in the upper room with the disciples. He offers them the Last Supper. He offers them communion. And in that moment, you see a communion happening between him and his disciples, an incredible picture of mutual submission. And remember who's in this room. Who's in this room are people he knows that are about to betray him. Judas is in the room. A guy who he knows is about to deny that he even knows him is in the room. People that are going to turn their back on him are in the room. And what does he do for them knowing this? It was Passover, the time when God's people remembered how God had rescued them from being slaves in Egypt. Every year they killed a lamb and they ate it. And the lamb died instead of us, they would say. But this Passover, God was getting ready for an even greater rescue. Jesus and his friends were having the Passover meal together in an upstairs room. But Jesus' friends were arguing. What about? They were arguing about stinky feet. Stinky feet. Yes, that's right, stinky feet. Now, the thing about stinky feet back then was that the people didn't wear shoes, they only wore sandals, which might not sound that unusual, except that the streets in those days were dirty. And I don't mean just dusty dirty, I mean really stinky dirty. With all those cows and horses everywhere, you can imagine the stuff that was on the streets that ended up on their feet. So anyway, someone had to wash away the dirt. But it was a dreadful job. Who on earth would ever dream of volunteering to do that? Only the lowliest of servants would do that. "I'm not the servant," Peter said. "Nor am I," said Matthew. Quietly, Jesus got up from the table, took off his robe, picked up a basin of water, knelt down, and started to wash his friends' feet. "You can't," Peter said. He didn't understand about Jesus being the servant king. "If you don't let me wash away the dirt, Peter," Jesus said, "you can't be close to me." Jesus knew that what people needed most was to be clean on the inside. All the dirt on their feet was nothing compared to the sin inside their heart. "Then wash me, Lord," Peter said, tears filling his eyes. "Wash all of me." One by one, Jesus washed everyone's feet. "I am doing this because I love you," Jesus explained. "You should do this for each other too." Then Jesus picked up some bread and broke it. He gave it to his friends. He picked up a cup of wine and thanked God for it. He poured it out and shared it. "My body is like this bread, it will break," Jesus told them. "The cup of wine is like my blood, it will be poured out. But this is how God will rescue the whole world. My life will break and God's broken world will mend. My heart will tear apart and your hearts will be healed. Just as the Passover lamb died, so now I will die instead of you. My blood will wash away all of your sins and you'll be clean on the inside in your hearts. So whenever you eat and drink, remember, Jesus said, I rescued you." Jesus knew it was nearly time for him to leave the world and to go back to God. "I won't be with you long," he said. "You're going to be very sad, but God's helper will come. And then you'll be filled with a forever happiness that won't ever leave. So don't be afraid. You are my friends and I love you." Then they sang their favorite song and walked up to their favorite place in Olive Garden. And in this picture, we get an image of what sacrificial love looks like, of what it looks like for somebody who doesn't need to sacrifice. So we're going to remember that sacrifice as we come forward today and take communion. We're going to sing one last song and we're going to break this bread and remember the sacrifice that he made. We're going to drink this, we're going to dip in this juice that represents the sacrifice that he made.
Thanks for tuning in to New Life Gillette. For more information, visit us on the web at www.newlifegillette.com. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And always remember, Jesus loves you very much, and he died to give you new life.